Hey, Voice Assistant. Programar cuarto nuevo.
Especificar el cuarto de la casa.
Atico.
Solo puedo agregar cuartos con internet.
Por eso, ahora que tenemos AT&T OFA y somos gigillonarios, hay cobertura de esquina a esquina, hasta el ático.
Recalculando.
Ahora con AT&T AllFi, agrega Wi-Fi de esquina a esquina. Obtén AT&T Fiber con AllFi y vive como gigillonario. Disponibilidad limitada. La cobertura requiere extensores por un cargo adicional.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
Howdy. I'm good. How are you doing?
Oh, I am tired. Today was a really busy day. Holy shit.
Yeah, you pushed me back half an hour.
Yeah. God, I started early today, too. Well,
did you?
Early by my standards, at least.
Do you want to share with people what early by your standards is?
It was like 9:30 this morning.
Oh, okay.
That's really early for me.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I'm an evening person, honestly. So I normally like sleep in the mornings. I get to the shop like 10, 10:30, and then I'll work until like 8, 9, something like that.
That's good. How is that for your home life?
Good. Although it might have to get adjusted because previously my girlfriend worked evenings.
Oh.
But now she's working days. So I may try to, and she's waking me up early anyway, so like I may have to push things forward a bit.
Yeah,
that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, we work until six on
right.
Most on weekdays except for Tuesday, Wednesday, and then I work until whenever I please. But I got a hard stop at six on regular days, so I try to get in here early. But you know, I got a baby,
mm-hmm.
and I bike to work because I live an active lifestyle and that takes me a while.
Yeah, I walk to work, and this afternoon coming back because I was running late for our recording session, I was like sprinting up the hill.
Because you know how strict I am.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew you were going to beat me.
But yeah, so how's your week going?
Good, just really busy. Like today was probably the busiest day. Today I fixed Millie's screen. I replaced it with a new LCD screen, which was nice. And I filmed the process of doing that, which always makes everything take a little bit longer.
Right. But that's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's great to have that fixed. You know, Millie's been down for the last week and a bit. So
how much of that are you going to have to edit of you being like, fuck?
Actually, not too much. This is the second time I've done that process. So, it took about 2 hours. Start to finish.
Yeah, I mean, 2 hours to do anything off schedule, like that you don't normally do, is pretty good.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
So. It's the sort of thing like where you're like, this will take me 30 minutes, and then 3 hours later.
Yes. You know? Yes, thankfully it wasn't like quite like that. And then right after that, I put together a pressure casting chamber, which I'm very excited about. A little nervous. One of those things where like anytime you're making a pressure vessel, if you're not nervous, you're not doing it right.
You should have a deep respect for that sort of thing.
Oh,
fear.
Yeah, absolutely. So pressure casting, basically like if you're casting epoxy or something, you can like vacuum degas the epoxy to get all the bubbles out. Mm-hmm. But then when you have to do that outside of your final product, you have to do it when it's like in the mixing cup. And then there's a pretty decent chance that you're going to get more bubbles when you're like pouring it into the final mold.
Right.
So pressure casting, basically you just like mix the epoxy, chuck it in the mold, and then chuck the whole thing in a pressure chamber and fill it up with high pressure air from your air compressor. And that crushes all the bubbles down to like nothing.
Cool.
Yeah, but the problem is that you can buy them cheaply, but it's just really not safe to do so. Like,
right.
So if you buy like a tank for your air compressor, they have to be ASME coded, right? Like, so they have to be like certified, they're tested, all that kind of stuff. It should be the same for these little pressure chambers, but there are tons of Chinese companies selling these on like Amazon.
Interesting.
You know, so you can buy one for like $160. And then if you read the reviews, people will be like, oh, you know, the bottom starts bulging out at like 60 PSI, but it works pretty good.
Yeah. That's my, one of my biggest fears is from early on when Tim and I bought like a cheap air compressor off of like this guy from like on Kijiji in Halifax. Right. And dude brought it over. We were like, cool, this is good. And then we started doing a little bit of research about like how they can be a little sketchy. And then we started realizing how sketchy this particular one was. It was like full of water. It was all rusty. Mm. It looked like a cheap one in the first place.
Right.
It never actually worked. So that probably saved us.
The safest air compressor is one that doesn't work.
It feels like you have a big grenade in your shop.
Well, and that's exactly what it is. So like I did the video, and one of the things, or video of making this process. And one of the things I said was like, you know, the way that a bomb works is you have rapidly expanding gas that fractures a casing, and then the expanding gas accelerates those fragments outward.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And a shitty pressure vessel is exactly the same thing. You just have no idea when it's going to go off.
Yeah.
You know?
How exciting.
So, yeah, exactly. So I was like, okay, I could buy an ASME coded pressure chamber, and they're like $1,700 US or more.
Yikes.
Which is pretty pricey. But I'm only doing pretty small stuff, so I decided I would buy some Schedule 40 3-inch NPT pipe off McMaster.
So you're making a pipe bomb.
Hopefully not. But yeah, with like that, with all the fittings, was like $250. Everything's rated to a working pressure, 150 PSI. And I looked up the actual like burst pressure of the pipe and the fittings, and it's like 2000 PSI. The safety margin is
huge. I was going to say, because you could bump it up to getting schedule, 80 or something? That's like the thick-walled stuff?
Yeah.
But if you don't have to, great.
No, it seems like overkill in this case. Yeah. So I've put a safety relief valve on it that pops 125 PSI.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nice little needle valve to fill it slowly so you don't disturb the epoxy. And it seems like it's good to go.
Do you have a gauge on it?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, I as soon as I built it, I was like, I wonder what would happen if I put a banana in this thing. You know, so I'm genuinely thinking you can get some sight glasses
that
are, you know, pressure rated, and so you could see into the chamber. I think I may actually replace the capped end with a reducer and a sight glass.
That's a hilarious idea.
Have you ever seen that YouTube channel, the hydraulic press channel?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I've seen those hydraulic press videos on like Instagram.
So I think maybe I'll start a YouTube channel, the high pressure channel.
Oh, I like it.
And just crush things in the pressure chamber.
If you get Queen on board, you could get that song, Under Pressure.
There you go.
That's a great idea. I would love to see things get crushed.
Right. And I'm sure that there would be some like really strange reactions.
For sure.
You know, like maybe banana would just get tiny.
Yeah.
Who knows, right?
What else could we do? A grape. I'm on the fruit train.
Yeah.
Now all I can think about is fruit.
I was thinking like, you know, ping pong balls, tennis balls, golf balls, all the balls.
Yeah, that's right. You do have a kink around crushing balls.
Mm-hmm.
How big is it? 3 inches?
It's 3-inch NPT, which means that the inside diameter, I think it's just a little bit over 3 inches.
Okay. Is a tennis ball? Under
I don't know
inches?
If it'll fit. I don't know if that would fit.
I'm like looking around my desk. Like, what can we crush?
What stuff can I crush?
Well, that's exciting. Cool. And so that's going to, you're going to be casting your handle scales in that.
Yeah. Not the entire handle scale, just the glow in the dark liner.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, but that will, like, I could have built a vacuum chamber instead, but you know, you run the risk of introducing bubbles when you're doing the pour, and it's actually kind of a fussy process to do it in the vacuum chamber because the mixture expands like bread dough when you release the pressure. So you have to, like, you know, have a big cup to make sure it doesn't overflow, and then you have to, like, wait for it to whatever. Like, the pressure chamber just seemed like a much faster.
Yeah, the other way sounds messy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so the inside of it is 3 1/16 inch diameter.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's pretty decent sized.
Where the hell did they get 3 inch?
I don't know. Well, you know, these imperial measurements, they don't make any sense.
Mm.
What have you been up to?
Man, I don't even know. I've been just trying to pump through this batch that I'm working on, which is going well. I'm like desperate to be transitioning. We're never making another body on the axes.
Okay.
That has been established, and we've made great progress on the body stuff.
Nice.
But I'm just so much more aware of how slow things are going on the axes now.
On the router, right? Yeah. Versus the Haas. Yeah.
Versus the Haas. So I'm going to keep building necks on it, but it's just been slow going, but same as it ever is. Like, mm-hmm. good progress, good results. Just you got to work for them.
Yeah,
totally. But we've got like some really cool guitars on order. You know, we do like everything custom. So I've got, you know, a neck that I'm working on right now that's got Brazilian rosewood fretboard and headstock. Brazilian rosewood's like super regulated. It's like ivory, so right. It's got to have permits and stuff. I'm doing one that's roasted bird's eye maple fretboard and headstock.
Oh, cool!
Which is really cool. So they actually. They basically put the wood into a vacuum kiln and toast it. And it, like, if you get roasted maple, it smells like maple syrup.
Ooh,
which nice. Is great. So in rosewood, the reason they call it rosewood is because it smells like roses. Mm. So it like smelled amazing in the shop the other day.
Like coffee and roses.
Yeah.
Maple syrup.
It was great. And then, yeah, just like lots of custom and like this batch. Has a lot of kind of finicky little custom things. Like we do this thing called tortoise shell purfling. A purfle is like a very thin banding or inside of the trim of a guitar.
Right. Inside the binding, right?
Yeah. Around inside the binding.
Right.
So just finicky stuff that takes time, but stuff I really enjoy and the end result is good. Like,
yeah, totally.
But yeah, that's what I've been working on. Yeah, wow.
So is this the first time you're doing a batch of work rather than
piece work? It's not. I've tried it before.
Right, but this is like the first official one, I guess?
Yes, right. And it is working. But... stuff just inevitably gets pushed ahead.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, like I just didn't get through the entire batch of one step. So I'm working on like 2, 4, 6, 7 guitars.
Right.
I didn't get through putting headstock and truss rods, headstock overlays, truss rods into all 7 necks. So I'm like, let me just re-strategize. I couldn't get it done today, so I'm going to move these tech. I'm going to, you know, prioritize these two guitars. They had the shortest like lead time currently, so I'm going to push these ahead. So yes, I'm still working on a batch, but I made some concessions, pushed a few guitars through for first, then because I also need to feed like the guys on the other you know stations, so I need to get guitars to them.
I feel like the hardest bit with a process change like that is kind of getting ahead of things so that you have a bit of a buffer.
Yeah.
You know, like if you had a stock, like you have been talking about kind of keeping stock of the individual components, like being your own customer.
Yes. So that's where I'm failing.
Yeah,
but I haven't had time any stock yet to do that. But I think the Haas is going to change that. Like, with new tooling, so end mills or insert mills, like a copy mill or a surface. What's the word? Surface mill?
Face mill.
Face mill. Thank you. things like that. They're, like we're really prioritizing machining time, like reducing machining time.
Right.
So that will get to us to a point where I'm like, I want to be able to do 10 bodies in a day, no problem.
Oh yeah. I think you'll get there.
12
really
bodies
quick.
In a day, something like that, you know? Then I can front load all this prep work.
Mm-hmm. I would think that you'll get there. I think that you will get to the point where it's a lot faster than that.
Yeah.
Like down to like a 30-minute cycle time or something.
Well, Mark's already got the body program. I think he's shaved like 11 minutes off of it. It's now like 20 minutes.
Right.
And we still don't even have that tooling yet. So there's tons of time savings to be had. Loading parts is going to be way faster.
Right. And then I guess that you're talking about doing some like prep work on the raw material on the same day, or is that not included?
No, I'm thinking, well, you know, you take a piece of, I would like to have a body blank, which is the two pieces of wood joined together that we make a guitar body out of.
Right.
Those are all pre-made. That's something we currently stock.
Right.
You just have to pass it across the jointer, which makes something flat once.
Right.
And then it's good to go. Okay. So that would be the only thing that I would do. And I could do that. You know, I joint the surface of one, get it on the machine while it's running, joint the next few, you know, get a little bit of a flow going there. I think we're close. We're really closing in on getting this thing going.
Right.
And then we got to move on to next.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're making solid progress. So looking forward to seeing some ultra speed.
I think some super speed. Yes. Nice. There you go. And also we're going to have to, I talked to Haas today about getting the high speed machining.
Mm. What did they say?
Said, just give us $3,500. We'll give you a code.
Right. So that's what you expected.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Right.
I don't think I'm going to score that 15% off that I had when I bought the machine. But
so there you go. If you're buying a Haas, just buy the high speed machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing though is it did save us $3,500 in cash at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So something else to consider. I mean, we did get 200 free hours. If you think about it, I mean, maybe.
Yeah, 200 hours could last you potentially months.
We could lead, you know, we could use that right up to the last minute and then buy it. He said, you give me, you guys, when you need it, I'll get that code immediately.
Right. That's so nice, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess the price could go up on it. Who knows, they might raise the price.
The stock exchange says today machining is $5,500. Right.
HSM on the ticker.
Yeah, I've been slammed as well. Just like, so a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago now, I guess, I sent out an email to all my customers announcing that I was doing the custom color combinations for my handle scales. So I had more orders than usual.
Great.
But yeah, which was fantastic. The only problem is at the same time, my girlfriend was away at the cottage with her mom, which is like the only person that she sees during COVID. Mm-hmm. And that meant that I was looking after the dog and looking after the house. So I had like more than a week of not being able to be out of the house for more than 7 hours at a time, because I had to come home and walk the dog. And that coincided with that time. So I ended up just trying to make the best of it and work on the kitchen knife. And that meant that I got like more than a week and a half behind production. And then I got slammed with extra orders. So I'm kind of eating it right now. I'm just like, you know, working as fast as I can. And I'm kind of like just treading water, you know?
yeah.
and still trying to get other stuff. Like I have other things that I have to do, like this, the pressure casting chamber. The reason I need to do that ASAP is because I have a customer that's been waiting since November for these glow in the dark scales, which were going to be easy, quote unquote.
You know? You made it complicated.
Well,
but out of necessity, because you have a high standard.
Yes. Yeah. If I'd been fine. So the reason that I'm chasing this crazy process down is that if I wanted to do just a layer of glow-in-the-dark powder, then it'd be totally fine. So you basically, you mix up a really sloppy mixture of epoxy and glow-in-the-dark, you pour it in there, the glow-in-the-dark settles to the bottom, and then you end up with a layer of glow-in-the-dark.
Right.
And then the rest of it's just a translucent epoxy.
Which might be cool on its own.
Yeah, it actually looks cool with the translucent G10. That looks great. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I went to the opaque G10, he specifically wanted black G10 with the glow-in-the-dark liner.
Like that's... Oh, the liner is glow-in-the-dark.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, because didn't you do the glow-in-the-dark handles? Like that.
Well, that was actually just the liner. Oh. And then it was glowing through translucent G10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wow. And that looks super cool.
Yeah.
But as soon as I went to the opaque, like the black handle scale, that layer of glow just looked like shit. So I've been like trying to get it to be solid glow, like right, all the way through the liner. And then, yeah, as you know, you have to have like more, basically what I'm doing is like packing it full of powder and mixing it with just enough epoxy to make it pourable.
Uh-huh. And what, how is the like quality of that material? Like, is, does it machine well still?
Yeah, it actually machines really nicely.
Okay, sweet.
The really the only issue that I have is just the voids, like bubbles.
Right.
Because the mixture ends up being so thick that it won't release bubbles. So that has led to this crazy pressure chamber thing. And then, yeah.
All right. So you've chased this down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But well, the results are going to be sweet. And then is this going to be a standard offering?
Yeah, absolutely. Because okay, well, it's one of those things where it's like, it's a pain in the ass and it's been kind of expensive to get set up. Like if I knew exactly what I was doing right from the start, then it would have been pretty quick. I would have just built the equipment and I'd be good to go.
Yeah, you'd need that learning curve. You need to fail first.
Yeah, 100%. But the pressure casting versus like vacuum degassing, it seems like it's kind of like a one and done. You know, you mix, you don't have to be really careful with getting bubbles in or anything. You pour it in and then you slap it in the pressure chamber and pressurize it and just wait, you know, mm-hmm. you just leave it in there for 24 hours and then it's good to go. Whereas the pressure, vacuum degassing seems like it's going to be very fussy. You know, you have to maintain your vacuum pump. You have to be careful not to get resin into the pump.
Right.
You know, you have to sit there and babysit the process and blah, blah, blah. So it seems like the pressure chamber will just be like a piece of equipment I never have to think about or maintain. It'll just work, you know, mm-hmm. which is sweet.
Until it blows up.
Fine, I hope not. I'm knocking on wood right now. And yeah, one of the other things I want to do with it is actually stabilize wood.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, before cool when you were idea. Saying the toasted maple, like I'm really curious to find out who your supplier is for that, because I would love to take like ultra dried maple or, you know, wenge or some other hardwood like that that's been, you know, vacuum heat treated basically. Mm-hmm. And then so I have these ultra high molecular weight polyethylene molds that I'm making. That was a bit of, I'll tell you that story in a minute. I was trying to make them before I came home just now. Uh-huh. And it was a hilarious failure. I destroyed a bunch of material. But the idea is you would put like a slab of material in this little kind of boat, like this mold, you know, pour the epoxy on top of it, then chuck it in the pressure chamber. And that should, you know, in the case of wood, that should force the epoxy into all of the pores on sure. the wood.
Yeah, yeah.
Theoretically.
I feel like I've seen this before.
People do it with vacuum. Like lots of knife makers do it with vacuum. But I haven't seen anyone doing it with pressure, I don't think. I'm sure there's probably someone that does.
Well, so like the wood we use doesn't really have voids. You know, it's maybe porous, but maple isn't porous.
Right.
So I don't know where that stuff would go.
Well, I mean, all wood is porous on a microscopic level.
Yeah, but...
Right. Then if the pressure is high enough and the epoxy is thin enough, then it'll get in there.
So it'll have to be Okay, so you're not talking about making it an aesthetic effect. You're talking about just making it, plasticizing it.
Yes. Yeah, basically turning it into G10.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. I mean, I've got scraps that you can try that on. I'd love to see the results.
Awesome, man. Yeah, next time I'm walking down, I'll have to come get some. Because, I think that'd be really cool. It'd be a really unique offering. Just the reason I haven't offered wood in the past is because, you know, it shrinks and moves so much that when I have that next to steel or G10, it's going to ruin the fit and finish when it moves.
Totally. You know, a lot of people, I guess, you know, like my mom has had a like Henkel kitchen knife since she got it as like a wedding present. And the handle scales are just like tiny.
Right.
Compared to
shrunk
the,
a lot.
Like, yeah, and, you know, because it gets wet. And dries and gets wet and dries and it's like all warped and crazy and the knife like is kind of wrecked.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a bummer. Yeah. So if you can remove that natural element from it, but still get the beauty.
Yeah. Then it would be perfect. Right. So
I think that would be amazing.
So yeah, that was kind of the other thing that I had in mind when making this pressure chamber. I've been thinking about trying that process for a long time. So two birds with one stone.
Very nice. Very nice. I got to do one thing real quick. I have to take a guitar out of the freezer.
Okay.
I'll explain in 1 second.
Please.
Okay. Be right back. And I'm back.
How big is your freezer? Is this like a regular freezer?
It looks like a refrigerator. It's vertical.
Oh, wow.
But it's just a single door freezer.
And you clearly got this to put guitars in.
We did.
What the hell? Why do you have to put a guitar in a freezer?
Because it's ice cold, baby.
Oh.
So one of the finish options we offer is a checked finish. We call it a light relic.
Right.
Finish.
And this
checking
is something that like makes it look antique, right?
I wouldn't say antique.
Vintage.
We call it closet classic. So as if somebody took a guitar that they bought in 1960, left it in a closet for 60 years.
Right.
It hasn't been marked by play wear, but the finish has had this natural process where that happens to nitrocellulose, which is the finish we use, where that it's a the finish is off gassing. The solvent is over years gassing off.
And that makes the finish shrink, I guess, right?
It makes the finish shrink, and what happens is the finish cracks. It gets this crackle effect that we call checking.
Right.
And so we force that. And the way we do that is we use a lacquer that has less plasticizer in it. Plasticizer is what makes lacquer flexible. Most people don't want the lacquer to check. You know, you'd be pissed if your car finish
got the crackle effect. Yeah, right.
You know, but guitar players have grown to love the aesthetic of it. So by using a finish with less of this plasticizer, it becomes, it's a little bit more, less flexible.
Right.
And then we do a process. It's like Tim does it. It's, there's a few different ways he goes about it, but one of the aspects is putting it in the freezer, and that, that temperature shock will help spread these cracks all across the guitar. It's very finicky. He's got a very like time sensitive process that involves several different, you know,
stages.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And that's one of them. Anyway, cool. So he had to take off, and he was like, "I'd left the guitar in the freezer. You need to pull it out in 30 minutes."
Right.
So that's why we have a freezer with a guitar in it.
Very cool. Yeah, I've seen that effect on your Instagram, and I honestly just never thought about how you did it. I was just like, oh, that looks cool.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everyone's got a different way of doing it. So, you know, people use freezers. People use, some people will just score it with a razor blade to make it look like that. It's, that's happened. Yeah. And this is cool because it just is, it is natural. Like, we can't control it, really. We've gotten to a point where we can control the way it cracks, but you can't be like, oh, I want to crack here.
Right. Anyways, that's part of the beauty of it, I think, right?
It worked great. I just looked at it quickly and it's all, it's all cracked. In the right way. You want cracks, you know, in a certain, in a certain style.
Yeah, totally.
So that's, yeah, that's what I've been working on.
Nice. Yeah,
you got sorry, go ahead.
No, I just, it's, I was just gonna say, yeah, it's just been a crazy week. It's just been like, I don't know where the time has gone. I'm sure you have weeks like that.
Yeah, I feel like every time we talk, we're like, oh, it's halfway through the week already. It's like,
flies by, man. Like, owning a small business, like, you just, there's things coming at you from every direction, you know? Like,
yes, there's a lot of things just besides the manufacturing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, I too mean, bad.
Yeah, I kind of wish that everything else would just take care of itself. But yeah, I mean, right now I'm juggling production, kitchen knife stuff, and then like the glow in the dark stuff as well, you know, and then Millie's screen broke, so I had to fix that. You know, it's just, it's always something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's just not enough hours in the day. Boy, are we griping or what?
Oh yeah. You got to gripe. Got to gripe, buddy. Speaking of griping, we have a listener sent me a correction from last week's episode. How dare you, sir? How dare you? No, it's, we were talking about SK versus ER collets.
Uh-huh.
And he's totally right. He corrected me that ER collets have greater grip and SK collets are supposed to have better run out.
Oh, okay.
And that's specifically what it says on the Maritool website. So 100%. The reason that I was thinking that SK collets had more grip is because I've kind of seen other manufacturers claim that, you know, they show like a cut with, an ER collet and the tool is like chattering and, you know, building up a lot of resonance and taking really horrible chips. And then they take the same cut with an SK collet and, you know, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think that's one of those areas where it's like different manufacturers will claim different benefits. And you know, part of it may be that they're holding different tolerances. So I don't know, you know, like SK is supposed to have better run out for sure. Grip, I think that depends on the manufacturer, what they say. Part of it too is, so I think the other system that I was looking at where the manufacturer was claiming higher grip, they actually have a different nut. So the inside of the nut is actually coated with an anti-friction coating, like DLC.
Oh.
That's supposed to kind of act like a ball bearing and allow you to get a lot more torque on the SK collet, which in turn turns into grip.
Could they put that on a ER collet and have even better grip?
Possibly. So you can actually get ball bearing ER collets, which serve the same purpose. Basically, they, you know, allow rotation more easily. Because normally the interface between the collet and the nut is, you know, causing a lot of friction, which limits the amount of torque you can get into the nut. And the other thing is, too, when you're applying that rotational torque to the collet, there's a certain amount of, like, wind-up and, like, twisting in the collet. And that's supposed to be bad for run-out. So systems like this that have, like, a ball-bearing nut or, you know, some sort of reduced friction between the nut and the collet, however they achieve it, it's supposed to give you better run-out as well. So, you know, I do know that Maritool are introducing a high torque SK collet nut soon. So maybe that will change the balance, you know? So yeah, I totally. So it was DM Ron101 on Instagram that sent in the correction. So thank you. I appreciate it. And yeah, I think in this case, it's just, it's like a back and forth depending on the manufacturer and the type of nut and so on, you know? Yeah, I haven't seen any numbers.
Mm-hmm. You should just test it for yourself.
Maybe. Actually, there is one video floating around where they put a big ass torque wrench, like eight feet long handle torque wrench on like a half inch pin that's held in an ER collet versus an SK collet. And I think in that case, they claimed that the SK collet had more grip.
Interesting. How do they keep it precisely, you know, like from twisting it? I feel like if you got an eight foot
well, that's what they're doing.
Lever. Yeah, but you're twisting it. You're rotating.
Yeah.
But how do you keep it from putting any, do you know what I mean? Like pressure.
I guess just the length of the grip in the collet kind of stops the pin from twisting. But yeah, you're right. You could
torque it the wrong way. Do you know what I mean?
Because the length of the lever would be pretty obvious if they were like pushing it up or down rather than just rotating it.
Right.
Interesting
yeah. experiment though.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think, DM run is correct. That on the Maritool website, it specifically says that ER collets have more grip than SK. Mm. However, I think that balance varies across different manufacturers and also the type of nut that you have. So, yeah, I don't know.
You got called out on your bullshit, Aaron.
I got called out 100%. And you know what, man? Like, I appreciate that because whenever you're wrong, it gives you an opportunity to learn new stuff, right? Oh, yeah. In that case, I actually just... like misremembered. I kind of like swapped in my head the two things. Mm-hmm. That's good. It's good for me to not misremember things. But yeah, I'll see if I can find some of the videos that were comparing ER and SK collets from other manufacturers.
Just want to see this 8 foot long torque wrench.
I think it was 8 feet. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe I'm over exaggerating. But yeah, I'll see if I can find the video because yeah, as you know, as I said, it's super interesting. And the other video, they were doing like full slotting cuts in steel with a half inch end mill and then showing the chips, and you could actually see on the ER collet there was like a feather along the edge of the chip because the tool was vibrating so much.
Wow.
Whereas the SK collet was like smooth and you could hear the difference in the cut too, right? So yeah, well, I'll try and post some of the videos.
I like the idea of the SK. It looks cool and everything. It's this for us, like we've been like cutting through mahogany is just like butter.
Yeah compared to like steel or 4140 like heat treated steel or whatever. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we have to resist getting too fancy with our tool holding.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I said that I thought for you end mill holders would be perfect because you have really long tool life, which means you're not going to be like replacing tools all the time. It doesn't have any slots or anything for the dust to get into. So yeah, when you do have to change, it's going to be super easy.
Yeah. No, I'm fully on board with the idea. And I've been looking, we talked about finding different tool suppliers or tool mm-hmm. manufacturers. And I have been on the hunt. And I've noticed some of them list the shank rating. Like the tolerance.
Right, shank tolerance. Because so, that's the thing that you're worried about. Is
that is the
if
thing
the shank
I'm
was
about.
Too small, then the end mill holder wouldn't work properly. So yeah,
yes.
I totally get that.
So if that is listed and it is, or it's rated, I can find out the rating, then I'd be way more inclined to just to do that because I love the idea. Again, like I, as a proponent of not having an ER collet set, which might be a dumb thing to be a proponent of.
No, it is a dumb thing, but that's fine.
we don't need 5/16 inch collet.
Well, and you're not a job shop. Like your tooling isn't going to change very much. So I do understand it. I still think it's dumb, but I understand. I think a couple of episodes ago, I said to you that you should reach out to Frank at Maritool and ask him about the specialist tooling that you have, whether it's something that he would want to stock.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, right after we recorded that episode, I sent an email to Frank because I was like, is this something I should say on the podcast? Like, do you want people to know that you're making like special tools for me? You're going to get swamped with requests. And he was like, no, man, bring it on. Like, whatever I can do to help, if we can have them made, we'll do it. So I don't know if you've reached out to Frank yet, but you totally should.
I haven't.
Well,
love his name.
Frank? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. There's a connection there.
He might want one of our t-shirts. No, I mean, I should because I don't think what we use is crazy. What we're currently using, I love like the ease of using his website. Mm-hmm. I did reach out to Harvey Helical. Haven't heard back.
Right. Well, let's see. Yeah, speaking of tooling disasters. So I think I said to you last week that I've been looking into ceramic fiber brushes for finishing in the machine.
Very interested in that.
Yeah, so I reached out to the Canadian distributor for those, and I sent them an email, and 2 weeks went past, and I didn't hear anything. So I call their head office. Their head office, you know, asks me where I'm calling from, and then they send me to another location that's like a half-hour drive away. Like, why do they have multiple offices that are like, you know, an hour, half-hour drive apart from each other? Anyway, so I talk to the other office. They tell me I have to talk to a certain sales rep inside the office.
Who's not there right now.
He's not there right now. Mm-hmm. I have to give him, they give him my email address. I have to like send an email. So I send an email. 2 days later, I hear, oh yeah, you know, look at the catalog. I look at the catalog and I send it, you know, like this whole process is now like 3 weeks, mm-hmm. you know? And so now I know that they're not cheap is what I know now. And I figured that was the case, but like, so it's like $500 to get it set up with one brush and one holder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not cheap.
But like, how, yeah.
A big part of that cost has to be the distributor.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like there's no way that they're going through all of this for less than like 25%.
No.
You know? So yeah, I just find it very frustrating. Like maybe maybe I should talk to Frank about trying to see if he can stock brushes. Like I would 100% buy them from him.
I know. I mean, I saw he reposted your stuff and like tagged knife making, and it's probably a small subsection of the industry he serves.
Very small, I think.
It's sometimes good to have these niche little things.
Yeah, 100%.
So
it was interesting, you know, like so one of my fellow knife makers, John Grimsmo, who's also in Canada, you know, he and I know each other. We're not like best of friends, but like I've got his number. I can text him, you know. And in this case, he that's a weird flex, isn't it? I've got I've got his number.
You should tell everybody it right now.
Oh yeah, yeah. 555-41. No, it's, you know, it's just nice. If I have a question or whatever, you know, I can send it to
have friends in the industry.
100%. You know, and like a little while ago, I was thinking about selling my vibratory tumbler and I was like, is this something you want? You know, like, it's just nice. As you said, it's nice to have friends in the industry. So that he posted on that post on Marital's Instagram and was like, holy shit, that's a good price for an end mill like that for the 8 flute, you know, and as far as I know, he doesn't buy any tooling from Marital previously, and maybe now he will. So,
well, I was checking out Lakeshore Carbide after you mentioned them because I'd heard of them before, and they sell it's a weird tool that will radius the spline of a
the John Grimsmo tool,
and that's how it was presented.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, and they have a whole tooling. It's like a tab. It's like knife making.
Yeah, because I think that John has had them make a bunch of specials for him in the past. And I guess, you know, he has the same relationship with Lakeshore that I do with Marital. I think that, you know, they'll make stuff for him. So, yeah, you know, it's just, I think it's super nice to have suppliers that you know, that have a vested interest in your success and you have a vested interest in their success. You know, it's so nice.
Also, the reason I was talking to Haas today is because he called me, Fabrizio.
Mm.
And I, you know what? I appreciate that. Like,
Cole, see how you're going. And
he's not like, he knows I'm not going to buy another CNC right now. Maybe I will in the future.
Right.
But it's a level of dedication to your customer's success.
100%. And, you know, if you do end up buying another machine, like, he wants you to have had a good experience with Haas.
Totally.
So that you'll buy another Haas.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can hear my dog's grumbling in the background. Sorry about that. She's very sad.
She's a Fadal girl.
Yeah, that's right. She's sad we're talking about Haases.
Yeah, no, it's a good lesson, though, as a business owner. Like, you know, I wish I had more time for this, but that customer experience is so important. And we do try. we really try yeah. to make that an important like facet of our business, but it takes time. And this guy is a dedicated salesperson, so he's got, you know, that's part of his job.
Yep.
You know, we're scrambling to do a little bit of everything. You know, you ship out a knife and you're like, okay, done. Now I can move on to the next thing.
Yeah. You know? I try to, so the online store platform that I use, Shopify, has an abandoned cart function. So basically if someone puts something in their shopping cart, then you can say, okay, if they don't check out within 24 hours, then send them an email.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
And a lot of companies that are selling, like, I don't know, shit they buy from China will say, like, you know, oh, someone's put something in their cart, but they haven't bought it in 24 hours. So we'll send them a 5% discount and that'll try and get them to sell it, okay, to buy it. You know. So what I did instead was actually take that as an opportunity to kind of introduce myself to the customer. Oh. And say like, oh, you know, hey, my name's Aaron. Like, I saw that you added a knife to your cart on my store, but you didn't make a purchase. Like, was there anything else I could do? And it's literally written like that. It's very conversational. Mm-hmm. So even though it's an automated email, it feels very personal. And if they respond to it, it goes straight to me and I'll write back to them.
You know? And it does become personal. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that there's lots of little opportunities to do stuff like that. I do the same thing with, like, I include a use and care sheet with every one of my knives now.
That's great.
And I sign it by hand and it says, you know, if you have any feedback, please, you know, call me or email me or whatever. So, like, yeah, you know, I think there are opportunities to kind of like high value, low effort.
Yeah. You know, well, like, so we just shipped out a guitar. And it was a customer, you know, it's always great when we can build a relationship with a customer, and it happens most of the time. We've got these, you know, relationships with these customers, and we always really appreciate their support. And this time I was like, I had a second, I was sitting at the table. I just filled out his spec, his certificate of authenticity,
right,
which has like a spec element to it where we write down all the specs, the weight, the neck thickness at 2 points. Mm-hmm. It's all handwritten. And I was like, I'm just going to write this guy a little note just to say thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I did. And it made me feel really good because I was like, you know, I'm truly thankful when anybody makes a purchase of one of our instruments.
Yeah.
And it made me feel good to know that he's going to receive this guitar and know how much it meant to us.
Totally.
Anyways, he called me today.
Nice.
He didn't mention that specifically, but he was very like appreciative of everything all the work we put into the instrument.
Totally. And I think being appreciative of the support of your customers is a super important thing.
Yeah.
I really say that too. You know? Yeah. 100%, man. 100%. That's really nice. Now we're talking business. I think that's honestly a great way to approach the business, you know?
Yeah. I mean, be humanistic. Be real.
Yeah, 100%.
It comes. It'll. You know, if you're not being real, it's obvious too. If you're, you know, if I, like that was. I guess even you know what, like Catherine, like my wife, bought something online from somebody who's probably shipping, 10-20 things a day off like Etsy, and they included a little thank you note that was just like printed. It's the same note, hand signed. It's still actually. Was like nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, totally. It was a lower value item. So even that little bit extra effort made a bit of a difference.
Experience. I mean, that's what I do. Like I fill out all the authenticity certificates by hand, but I just, you know, have a little thank you letter. One thing that I do want to do is to put that thank you letter on nicer paper. Right now it's just on printer paper. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel very special.
You know? But that's good that you still did it. Cause that's literally, I'd had this idea before. I'd had this urge to write this thank you note before. Mm-hmm. I was always like, well, I need to get them printed on like nice paper. And I literally just had a post-it note and I wrote it on that. And I was like, fuck it. Like I'm friendly with this guy. He'll get over the fact that it's written on a post-it note. I ordered a record of off of online. I forget what the name of the site is.
Right. But
on every Friday they put 100% of the or occasionally on Fridays, they put 100, give 100% of the profits of the record sale to directly to the artist. Anyway, so I was like, I bought a record and the guy wrote me a nice thank you note on a post-it note.
Right. Yeah. You know what, man? Like, I'm sure you've heard that saying, that like perfection is the enemy of the good.
Sure.
Like, you know, if you, and I experience this all the time, and I'm pretty sure you do as well. Like, we are perfectionists. We want everything to be perfect. But if you wait until it's going to be perfect, it just never fucking gets done.
And it's too late. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good lesson. I need to learn that more. Because I'm always held back by that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been interesting. So, you know, as I said, I recently rolled out the custom color combinations to everyone. So right now I have 3,500 different possible combinations of the
yeah, that's awesome. I like that you did that math. I should ask you your formula because I want to do that.
Oh, it's very, very easy. You just do, you know, like, if so for you guys, it'd be like the number of headstock overlays times the number of fretboard options times the number of finishes times the, or you just do, you know, each option times every other option.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it. But like in the future, so if I roll out all of the options that I would like to, it's going to be like 35,000 options. And you know, I was aware going into this that my organization, my current level of organization, like the way I'm organizing everything, isn't up to the task of managing that.
Right.
But you know, if I'd waited until it was, then it never would have happened. So instead, I'm using the pressure of organizing this to force me to you know, like, build processes to handle the complication, right? Yeah, so, you know, like, I sent you a photo the other day of that, like, thermal label.
Yeah.
So I've got, like, a thermal label printer. I'm printing this little label for each of my boxes. Yeah, no, it looks great. So it has, like, on the outside, it's a little obfuscated because I don't want people to look at it and be like, oh, that's a knife. You know, so instead of saying like blade, it says BLA,
right?
It's obvious what it is if you're looking at it, but you know, so I have an option, a place for blade, scale, liner, sheath, and then the serial number. And I just fill each one out by hand. And then on the inside, it tells you the like, you know, environmental responsibility steps that I'm taking as part of making that knife. And yeah, it's super easy. That was like an hour to design, cool. And now I can just print them on demand.
And now it's just, and now every knife comes with that.
Yeah, which is really, really nice.
I like that. I love that cherry red.
Oh, it's so good, right?
Mm-hmm. I like red. I like red guitars. Mm-hmm. They don't do a ton, but every time I'm like, I think I'm a red guy. I am like kind of, that's my complexion is kind of red.
Bit ginger.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't make up my mind which is my favorite color of the options that I offer.
I think if I was going to get one from you though, it would be something bold and bright like that because of the function of it. Like I do camp. And I want, like, that's why the glow and dark, the dark is such a great idea. Like, I want to be able to find this.
Yeah,
or totally. See it if I drop it in the water. Like, I used to do whitewater canoeing, and I had a knife attached to my life jacket, and the handle was bright yellow.
Yep. Yeah, so you see it.
So I can find it.
Totally. Yeah, it's really nice to have that as an option. You know, like, I have multiple high visibility options now. I have the toxic green, blaze orange, which is like hunter orange.
Yes.
And the cherry red.
That's great.
And then I can do any of them with a glow liner, which is awesome.
That is a very cool option. I'd be hard pressed to pick, to be honest. What do you think your favorite is?
I have no idea. Every time someone orders something new, I'm like, oh goddamn, this is my favorite now.
You know what would be just badass is black with like what you're doing, black with the
glow in the dark,
glow in the dark liners.
Yeah, yeah, and that is definitely one of my favorites is the black and green. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like one of the big differences that I'm doing with my glow in the dark is that it actually has like a really nice daylight color.
Yeah, I was explaining this to Tim, my brother, and it's something that I never even thought about because when I picture glow-in-the-dark material, it's like pale white.
Yeah, that pale, shitty pale green kind of color.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. I guess you could call it green. It's like almost white.
Yeah, and they're pretty much all like that. But I'm actually able to change. I haven't tried it yet, but theoretically, I should be able to do like orange daylight and green at night.
That's wicked.
The nighttime color is always. I was going to say the nighttime color is always the same. That's not true. I can actually order like 16 different colors.
Variations of green?
No, like orange. You can get glow in the dark orange.
That would be cool. I want that.
Yeah, the problem is that green is the brightest and lasts the longest.
Yeah.
Because they have to change the chemistry to change the color. Okay. So I think the second brightest is aqua.
Oh, that would be cool too. Yeah, so this is what like guitar side dots, like to so you can see the fingerboard. Mm-hmm. Green and aqua are the two colors that I know of that you can get.
The glow in the dark ones? Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you're talking about letting, you know, having it last 24 hours. What does orange last? 8? I mean,
I have no idea.
I like that would be enough still. I would maybe take that
for the novelty value.
Sure. I mean, 8 hours is plenty.
Yep.
You know, if it was like 1 hour, maybe I'd reconsider. But
the company that I ordered my glow in the dark material from is called Technoglow. And they have a ton of colors on their website.
So very sweet.
Go check it out.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so today's episode is just going to be us shooting the shit because neither of us have had the time to do segments. Like I haven't looked at any space stuff this week. I haven't looked at anything.
No, I have looked at some space stuff.
Oh,
I'm reading a book right now. Okay. I read it about 10 minutes at night when I can and I fall asleep, but it's the history of astronomy.
Oh, cool.
So that's my space info is going to be pretty dated.
Historical.
Yeah.
Space history.
Yeah. So like Alexandria and, you know, trying to decipher the distance from the Earth to the sun by like triangulation.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting, like really high quality mirrors for making telescopes were probably one of the first instances of like really high precision objects.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
And that'd be grinding. They would have been grinding those, right?
Yeah. And so there's a really cool, I found a really cool video on YouTube of a guy. He's a professor from the States, an astronomy professor. I think he died recently, but he teaches classes or taught classes on how to grind a telescope mirror by hand.
Well, because I guess it would have been the scientists who wanted them that were doing it a lot of the times.
And to do this, he's using literally nothing other than pitch. So like, you know, tree sap, basically. I forget the abrasive that he's using, but it's...
Could be like, what's that like? Powdered Vulcan... volcano rock?
Powdered volcano rock? Obsidian? No. It's not like aluminum oxide. It's like cerium oxide, maybe?
Oh, okay. Something much harder, though.
No, it's pretty soft. It's pretty soft. But yeah, and he's literally got like a class of people in his backyard sitting on wooden benches with like, you know, a form made out of like tree wax, like pitch. And then grinding these huge slabs of glass to make perfect telescope mirrors.
Wow.
And these things are like...
And that's precision?
2 feet in diameter. You know, like, they're huge. And yeah, so they do this process called... I believe it's called coloring. Where basically you shine the reflection from your mirror on a big surface. And you just use the variations in light intensity to... see how close it is to being perfectly spherical. And then you just, you know, grind a little bit more in one spot and that whole process just intrinsically becomes extremely accurate.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Pumice was the word I was looking for.
Oh, yes. It might have been something like that. Because I'm pretty sure that they would have just been using like a natural rock crushed
I think pumice is one of the oldest abrasives used for, you know, this sort of thing. Like,
right.
One of the first guitar finishes we ever did was a shellac, French polish, and we used pumice as an abrasive.
I remember you guys going through that process. That was a very long process.
Oh man, it was a nightmare. But something you can easily do by hand with cheap materials.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that's this. So this professor, his whole goal was to like, let people build really high power telescopes at home.
So cool. What a wicked hobby that would be.
Right. So, they're building reflector telescopes. So you have a mirror at the bottom and then an eyepiece at the top in the middle. And the light goes around the eyepiece, bounces off the mirror, the curved mirror at the bottom, and then goes back up into the eyepiece and out the side. And these telescopes are huge. Like, really? I'm talking like 6 feet long, 2 feet in diameter. And like, you know, you're looking at like one part of a crater on the moon. Right. Like really high powered telescopes. And they're making them for like under $1,000, like well under $1,000. The outside tube of it is actually one of those big paper tubes that they use for forming concrete.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like cardboard.
Yeah. Sort of. Yeah. Oh. Like it's like paperboard.
Wow.
You know, and then like the inside assembly that holds the mirror in place is like made out of 3 bits of wood, and you kind of like hammer it into place. You look through the telescope at night to like align it.
Then
once it's in place, you just like hot glue it. You know, like it's crazy, man. Like, and it's, you see some of the images that he gets through these telescopes, and it's like, holy crap.
Man, that's sick. Okay. Link in bio or whatever.
Yes, sir. Link in the show notes.
Show notes.
So yeah, you know, like astronomy's had definitely like a huge impact on like the kind of precision that people have been seeking over time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and astronomy is kind of tied to horology in a way, mm-hmm. and the like latitude and longitude. Which one came first? Which one came second?
Oh, I have no idea.
One of them was like easy, and then I think latitude was like it took ages to figure out. That's also a great book I read a while ago.
What was that?
How to find it was about the search for the how to calculate latitude.
Right. Yeah, we don't even think about that stuff these days. We just have GPS. You know, yeah. But like, yeah, imagine sailing a ship across the ocean with like dead reckoning and a hand-drawn map. Like, yeah, it's shit's crazy.
Yeah. No, not for me. I'll just, you know, we don't even have fucking a map in our car. You know, I used to have like, I remember my mom pulling over on the side of the road
with one of those books where it's the next map on this side is page 53. You have to flip through.
I actually have one in the trunk of my car with the spare tire because Catherine's, my wife's mom, insisted we have one.
Yeah, you know what?
Like, it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, if all your phones die.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
At least you know where you are.
Exactly.
Okay, so we talked about space. Do we have any questions?
There were some, but I honestly haven't had time to look through them. One of our listeners, DL Knife on Instagram, was asking whether we had looked at Swiss lathes.
Oh, I have not looked at them, but I've watched like some videos on Swiss lathes because I think they're cool as fuck.
Mm-hmm. He was saying, if I ever decide to produce my own Corby bolts, that's the way to go fast. And yes, I 100% agree, Dave. A Swiss lathe would be amazing. And one of my fellow knife makers, John Grimsmo, who's getting 2 shout outs this episode. He has an awesome podcast too called Business and Machining. Yeah, he has a Swiss lathe and that thing looks terrifying to program.
He does it all by hand too, right? All hand coded.
Yeah. And I think most Swiss lathe guys do.
Right. They don't have,
I guess cam would be really complicated. I don't know why they
look crazy. I don't know what the hell's going on in one of those things, you know. And it's full of oil, like, and it's just like a bomb.
Yes. So
they blow up all the time.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really that uncommon.
So there's a guy that I follow on Instagram. I think his Instagram is Knife Screws. He was machining hardened 17-4 stainless in his Swiss, and it caught fire. Mm-hmm. Because I guess there's a lot of like vaporized cutting oil inside the machine, and then you're potentially producing sparks and heat.
Yeah.
And yeah, you just saw this like boom, and like, you know, smoke starts jetting out of the corners. And then his machine has an automated fire suppression system.
Yeah, I think they have to.
Right. I've been looking into that a little bit, actually, because I want to start running more unattended. Mm-hmm. And I've done that in the past. I've never had an issue. I think that for what I do, it's fairly low risk. But I am using a vacuum system.
Yes.
And I'm machining G10, which it's not, it's supposed to, actually. So there's two grades of G10. There's G10 and then there's G10 FR4. And the FR4 stands for flame retardant.
Oh, okay.
So I've never tried lighting the G10 dust that I produce on fire, but there's a good chance that it'll burn because it's dust.
Uh-huh.
Right. So
you got to be careful, especially with vacuum. I mean, I tried thicknessing celluloid acetate, which is a type of plastic once,
right,
with vacuum, and it's just a big fireball right through the vacuum duct.
Yeah, and celluloid is extremely flammable.
It sure was.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm sure you won't appreciate me saying this, but you guys have amazing guitar picks that are
yeah,
celluloid.
Yeah.
And right after you gave me a couple of them, I insisted on setting one on fire in your parking lot. I think you saw that, right? Because they burn amazingly
well. They do. And I'm going to need 25 cents for that destruction of my property.
Seeing celluloid burn is crazy.
It's funny. I gave one to my wife's cousin who was like 12 at the time, and I was like, psst, these are very flammable.
I'm sure, yeah, if you'd said that to me at his age, I would have been like, thanks, dude.
Sick.
Yeah, let's burn it. Yeah, and I mean, there's been a bunch of fires over the years in like theaters and in places that old school film. Because, like, you're talking, like, hundreds of feet of thin celluloid film that's very, very flammable. Yeah.
Cool. So, well, was that exciting? Talked about pipe bombs, and was it exciting to almost
burn your shop down?
It got my heart pumping.
I bet. So, there's a product that you might be interested in. It is called Blaze Cut.
Sounds sick.
Yeah, it's really cool. So I've been looking at it for a while. They're a little expensive, but I think that it might be worthwhile. So basically, it is a clean agent fire suppression. So, you know, like carbon dioxide is a clean agent. It doesn't like cover all your electronics in awful corrosive powder, you know. But then there are other clean agents that are like Halon is one of them, and you know, there's just other things that are like much better at putting out fires than CO2. So basically, Blaze Cut, they make tubes, like plastic tubes, filled with really high pressure clean agent fire suppression stuff, and then you put it inside your machine or whatever, like you or in your vacuum, and when there's a fire, it melts the tube, and then the fire suppression agent is released automatically and puts out the fire.
Yeah, that's awesome. I would like that everywhere. I'm scared.
Yeah.
Fire.
So they are a bit on the pricey side. I'm just on their website right now. An 84-inch long blaze cut system is $300 US.
Oh. I thought that was going to be way more.
No, it's not bad. But like if you were to put it everywhere, then yeah, you're going to spend thousands of dollars.
Right.
But yeah, man, like if that's something you're worried about, there are systems out there. That do it.
That's good to know.
Yeah, and there are also like dry powder fire extinguishers with like a sprinkler head attached to them.
Right.
So you could like put one in your house, and if it catches on fire, it'll, you know, the little glass thing will burst, and then the fire extinguisher will spray everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a thing.
Yeah. Well, you have fire suppression in the spray booth, which is mandatory.
Right.
Because we're spraying particulated nitrocellulose.
Which, again,
it's oil-based.
Right.
Very finely particulated. So when we were replacing the spray booth fan, I had to make sure I didn't knock one of them, one of the sprinkler heads. I was nervous about that.
Well, so you may not know this. Another name for nitrocellulose is gun cotton.
Oh.
And gun cotton is one of the most powerful chemical explosives known to man.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Glad to know. I imagine what we're using is probably somewhat
different. I don't know if it is.
Okay. I don't know why I think that. I'm trying to stay on the positive side.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I don't think it blows up in your case because it's full of solvent, so it's just going to burn anyway.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, we've definitely crossed the gamut today. Yeah, as you said, we've talked about pipe bombs, accidental or otherwise.
Uh-huh.
Burning guitar picks.
We've got ourselves blacklisted, I think.
God. Dude, all the things that I Google sometimes, I'm like, oh, nitrocellulose sounds interesting. How do you make that stuff? Or I said to Craig, you know, a couple of months ago, one of the YouTube channels that I love is called Tech Ingredients. And the, you know, the guy just makes all sorts of crazy stuff. And he's been on a kick of making rocket motors, solid rocket motors recently.
Cool.
And, you know, so you have to get, you know, all sorts of different chemicals to put in these rocket motors. And I start Googling them. And it turns out a bunch of them are controlled substances in Canada. Uh-huh. And they'll totally get you on a, you know, this guy might make bombs kind of list, right? So, yeah, I'm sure I'm on a list somewhere.
Yeah, especially as like an, you know, repatriated person.
I love, for everyone that's listening, I love Canada. Like, let's be clear. All right, so
you should not let him back to Australia, though.
Yeah,
if,
no.
If you know what's good for you.
I don't like Australia. No, that's not true. I do like Australia, mainly for the weather.
What's wrong with our weather?
Oh,
I've never been to Australia. It looks hot.
It's beautiful. You should go. All right. Is that a show?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think so. Well, it was awesome to talk with you as always.
Likewise.
I hope everyone enjoyed our ramblings. We will try to have some space news for next week. I too love space news and segments in general. So we'll try to get some. If you want us to go back to Aaron Reed's Mead comments, then go on my YouTube channel and just talk shit to me.
Yeah, that's a great idea, actually.
Yeah. And yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
Cheers.
Hope everyone has an awesome week.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.